gonna spend the rest of my life telling this story, ain't I?
We know the dangers. Is it one person using it?
I'm gonna have some muzzle.
Alright, I'm good.
Here we go.
Hello, and welcome to this very special live episode of At the Meadow. I'm your host, Joseph Carver. The Meadow is where we gather to discuss all things innovation and creativity in independent schools. As I mentioned, we have a very special guest this week. It's not that often you get the opportunity to sit across the table from one of a kind, from an iconoclast. But this last week, Alex Honnold, the noted climber from the documentary Free Solo, joined the Meadow School community for a conversation with myself and our head of school and our upper and middle school students, as well as some guests that we invited. We had the opportunity to record the conversation and now are going to be able to share it with you. We're incredibly grateful for Alex's willingness to come to campus. The conversation is wide-ranging about how to set yourself up for success and what visualization means and fear and managing processes. It's an incredible glimpse into an incredible mind, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and we are thrilled. So I hope that you enjoy this episode of At the Meadow.
Here we go.
Good morning, Meadows Mustangs. It's an awesome day for us to come together and to celebrate having an extraordinary member of our community here on campus today. And in just a few moments, as you can see, Alex Honnold is going to share his life experiences with us, talk to us about a variety of topics, and probably completely blow all of us away. And if you've seen the films, read the stories, purchased the book, or happen to be out at Red Rock Canyon or Mount Charleston, then you already know the magnificent career that has led Alex to this moment and how he's become one of the greatest athletes, perhaps, of all time. Free Solo, the film that has been shared widely across our community over the last month, that shows Alex climbing El Cap, not only documents his record-shattering accomplishments, but it also won the Academy Award for Best Documentary Film that year. Alex has a variety of records for climbing and free soloing. He was the first and only person to free solo Moonlight Buttress in Zion National Park, and also the northwest face of Half Dome in Yosemite National Park. And of course, the 3,000-foot free solo of El Capitan that he did that shattered the record for free solo climbing. It completely reframed what is possible for the sport as well as what we believe is possible for humans to accomplish. And just for some perspective, that free solo climb of 3,000 feet is taller than the Burj Khalifa by 300 feet. 3,000 feet in 3 hours and 56 minutes. I've seen the film many times, and each time it leaves me without words. It's exceptional. I'd also like to provide a little bit of framing for today's theme, the pursuit of excellence, our school's motto. It's clear that Mr. Honnold has been pursuing excellence for quite a long time, and today you're going to hear about how that talent, how that passion has taken years to develop, cultivate, and truly flourish. The product of this is what we see on TV. But the process, and I want to emphasize that, the process is this constant daily commitment to being the best version of himself, the very best version of ourselves. Alex is a superhuman, but he was young at one point, younger than he is today. He grew up in Sacramento, California. He started climbing at the age of 11. He carried a 4.7 GPA and matriculated to UC Berkeley. Alex is also the founder of the Honnold Foundation, an environmental nonprofit which seeks simple, sustainable ways to improve the lives of others worldwide. It has a global footprint, and it's improving lives in a variety of ways. Finally, Mr. Honnold is also a proud husband and father of two amazingly beautiful young children, and we hope, since they live in Summerlin, sometime not too far from now, they may be part of our Meadows Mustang family. I would be remiss before we go on without saying and mentioning today's special visit, a very special thanks to several people. And I would ask for a round of applause for our technology and facilities teams, our campus safety team, Ms. Casanello and Ms. Jensen, our partners with 3G audio, video, and lighting, and for Mr. Carver, our chief innovation officer, who I think has been emailing Mr. Honnold's publicist for about 3 years to try to make this happen. We're so grateful for all their efforts. Please join me in thanking the people who made today possible. And now, and without further ado, please help me make some noise, a generous round of applause for our special guest, the one, the only, and the extraordinary, Alex Honnold.
Thanks for having me.
I don't want to put you on the spot and start by asking, why did it take 3 years for me to get it? But I'll start with a quick note. Apparently your bio is not entirely correct. You believe you graduated with a 4.87 GPA. And in this place of all places, it's important that we note that.
I'm True. Getting a pen out and writing it down.
It's been a long time. I don't totally remember.
So,
but I think so, though. I was quite proud of it at the time.
Before we get started, Alex, I just want to take a moment to do a little bit of housekeeping. For students and faculty and guests, obviously Dr. Berkeley did a beautiful job welcoming you. We'd like you to know that after we've had about 30 minutes of questions, the mics that you see back here are for you. We would encourage you, I'll give you about a 5-minute warning to line up behind the mic so that you can get your questions answered. Also, when we're finished with the Q&A and there's dismissal, anyone who has a book that would like it to be signed will line up along that wall where the blue table is, and Alex will sit there to sign those books. We've been asked to allow the middle school students to be first in that line so that they can get back in time for their schedule. So please accommodate that, upper school students. And with that, let's get started. So, Alex, you grew up in Sacramento, child of two educators, started climbing when you were 11 years old. The first two things that I want to know is, one, was there a sport or a passion or an interest that predated climbing? And secondly, at what point in that childhood journey did you start to realize you were creating distance from your peers in terms of skill set?
Oh, it took a long time. So I didn't have any particular athletic background. Like you said, both my parents were teachers and they just taught. We would go camping, we'd go hiking, we'd go outdoors a little bit, but nothing extreme, no big anything. We just kind of would enjoy the outdoors. I did maybe a year of gymnastics. It's kind of a common joke in the climbing community that people become rock climbers because they're bad at everything else. Like if I could catch or throw a ball, I maybe would have gotten into ball sports, but I was really bad at everything. So no, that's not totally true. I was probably generally athletic. You know, I could run, I could do things, but I wasn't really great with team sports, not great with eye-hand coordination, too shy to play on a team really. And so I just got into rock climbing.
So you joined a local gym? And I remember reading in your book that you talked about how the first time that you went out to really climb, one of the ways that you sort of found yourself doing free solo was you were not confident enough to approach other climbers. Can you talk a little bit about how that influenced the decision?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, so I grew up at a suburban climbing gym. I mean, you know, I grew up in an area similar to Summerlin, which is kind of like, except with no mountains. I guess from here you can see mountains and you can see, you know, things to climb. But I grew up in Sacramento, California. It's just flat. And so to me, rock climbing was just in the gym. And I spent from age 10 or 11 until 18 basically climbing at the gym all the time. I'd bicycle to the gym. My dad would take me to the gym. But I didn't really have that much connection with the broader mountain climbing community, like real rock climbers. And I hadn't really climbed outside very much. And so when I did finally start climbing outside a little bit, I just didn't really know how to approach people as to, you know, and I was just young and shy and scared. And so I just found myself climbing by myself more often than I maybe would have. But part of that is also because I do like climbing by myself. But just to be clear, I mean, I suppose we're probably going to spend a fair amount of time talking about free soloing and climbing ropeless, climbing by myself. But that's a small fraction of the climbing that I normally do. And most of my time is spent training, climbing with partners, climbing with ropes. I mean, actually, this photo is a perfect example. I mean, we're rappelling, you know, it's like we're using ropes. We climb this giant arch with ropes. We spent a couple weeks there working on it with ropes. So most climbing is safe and chill. And then the free soloing, the climbing without a rope, is sort of it's like my Super Bowl or my World Cup, you know, my occasional thing throughout the year where I really sort of test myself.
You know, I like how you looked back at this image and said this was pretty chill. I'm not sure that's my Saturday afternoon of chill.
It's exciting, but very safe.
Very safe.
Yeah.
I wonder inside of that, if you could talk to us when you started climbing at 11, 12 years old, not very distant from some of the ages of some of the students in this room, Did you imagine it would become this? Did you imagine it would become LCAP? Was that part of the plan, or was it just something you loved and you dove in?
Yeah, it was just something I loved. I mean, honestly, I'd always loved climbing on things, climbing on structures and trees. And, you know, as a little kid, I would get on top of the play structure all the time. And so my parents took me to the climbing gym thinking that it would be a safer outlet. So they were like, oh, at least it's structured. At least it's got padded floors. At least it's got ropes. Like, sure. You know, he can do all his climbing in a slightly more confined space. And no, I mean, I was so disconnected from this broader world of real mountain climbing that to me, climbing was just going to the climbing gym. But I just love doing it. I mean, I like doing it more than anything else.
You were clearly a very good student. I think that gets glossed over a little bit in Free Solo and other pieces of media that's been done about you, but being a student at UC Berkeley is not an easy thing for anyone. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the sort of transferability of your approach to both climbing and your approach to school. Was it similar in terms of focus and dedication? Like, where did you start to build the muscle memory that it took to say, I can chart this from the idea that I have about soloing or climbing to the, as you say, your Super Bowl? And did that transfer to your academics or any other parts of your life?
I mean, a little bit. I'll say I've always taken climbing a lot more seriously than my academics, which is why I only did 1 year at UC Berkeley and then went rock climbing instead. But that said, I actually do often think, so I went to a high school in Sacramento. I did an IB program, like nice, you know, it's probably a similar level of education as a school like this. And I do often appreciate the education that I got because, as it turns out, you know, I've now written books and done films and done all these things. And, you know, I'm like currently writing this thing for the New York Times. Like, there's a lot of weird opportunities that have presented themselves to me as part of being a professional climber that I just would not be prepared for without having had a good high school education, because as it turns out, that's all the education I got. Mm-hmm. And so it's a good thing that it laid a good foundation for me. I don't know, I mean, I think the amount that I've traveled, the amount of weird experiences that I've had in life now, I'm like, thank goodness I had a good foundation upon which to build everything else.
I wonder if, you know, we live in an age where I think most of our teachers have some sort of relationship with their students after they graduate. And we love when they come back to campus, whether it's around the holidays or at the beginning of the year. Do you still connect with some of those teachers back in California? Do they reach out and say, I knew you when? Was there a detention story somewhere back there?
No detention stories. I had perfect attendance. I was like,
perfect
I was
attendance.
I was an overstoked student in some ways, which... No, I stay in touch with a few of my teachers. Many have retired now, which, you know, I'm getting old. I don't know. I mean, I still remember a few of my teachers specifically. So, actually, I mean, this is sort of, I don't know if it's relevant for a school, but through my high school education, I started at basically A pluses, perfect attendance, way oversight, going really hard. And then through the 4 years, I got more and more into climbing, spent more time climbing, and also realized that at least at my school, the GPA didn't affect if you had a 90.0 or a 99.9. And so by the end of my high school career, I was really right on the line of 90.0 in every class. And I almost took certain pride in managing to do the bare minimum and still coast through with a great skill. But it basically just allowed me to spend more time doing the other things I cared about, which is biking to the climbing gym. And, you know, I went to nationals those years. I was competing at a higher level as a climber. And I actually remember one teacher specifically basically taking me aside and giving me a talking to, because, you know, I'd gotten an A on something, but he was like, I can tell you're not actually putting real effort into this. And he's like, I want to see effort. You know, I don't care about results. I want to see real effort. And that's kind of stayed with me for 20 years. But anyway.
It seems like there's a recurring theme about attention to details and preparation in every part of your life, whether it's in school, even if you are just calculating what it takes to get the bare minimum,
the bare minimum.
It's still a form of preparation. We've got a short video. You can watch it in this monitor, and then we've got some questions to unpack after, if that's okay.
I didn't know we had movies. I'm excited.
We have movies.
Free solo climber Alex Honnold has accomplished some of the most amazing feats of climbing ever done on Earth, including ascending the 3,000-foot El Capitan in Yosemite National Park without a harness or rope of any kind. That's taller than 2 Empire State Buildings stacked on top of each other. In order to achieve something so incredibly dangerous, where a single mistake is instant death, Honnold stakes his life on preparation. He does numerous run-throughs with ropes, so he knows exactly where every single step will be, which gives him the confidence on climb day. He's always insisted that he feels fear, He just prepares to the point that he knows he'll be able to accomplish his goal by mentally rehearsing everything that could happen. The preparation is what keeps him at ease. Fear never totally disappears, but each practice run is like a rock hammer chipping away at stone. There is no adrenaline rush, he once told 60 Minutes about his climbs. If I get a rush, it means something has gone horribly wrong.
So, fair enough. If I get a rush, it means something's gone horribly wrong. Let's dive right into the preparation conversation, because I think that one of the more memorable scenes in a lot of our community's seen Free Solo is you with what I think you call your climb log, or I don't know.
Yeah, my climbing journal.
Your climbing journal. And you're reciting step by step, hold by hold, the LCAP solo, Free Solo, or at least in part, right?
Yeah, and the important parts for sure.
If challenged, if I said to you, could you just go step by step through eight of that, could you do it now?
Yeah, I could talk you through most of the wall. I mean, it's been a few years, so I'm starting to forget a few things, but no, I could get you
Can you just give us a little sample of what that sounds like to you in your head when you're preparing?
What, you mean the actual movements?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I don't know, I don't even know, like, how granular do you want?
Well, what I found interesting was that the language of the holds and the language as you described.
Oh, yeah, like small cramp, crossover, down pulling edge, toe on a little dimple, turn your knee in, turn the hip, reach over, like that kind of movement.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so that's ultra granular. That's like the very small, you know, fine level of detail. But I think the bigger picture is you think about the whole wall, you think about the parts that are the most challenging, you think about the, because also, you know, on a 3,000 foot wall, like on LCAP, a third of it is relatively easy, and then a third of it's kind of medium, and then a third is quite hard. And so of the hard parts, I memorized it all at that level of detail. The medium parts, you really can mostly kind of trust yourself to flow up it and just cruise, and then you kind of memorize specific little sections of it, like just the crux sections, just the most difficult parts. And then the easy stuff, you just know that you can do it fine.
You talked a little bit with Dr. Berkeley and I about the equation that you have for preparation, like selecting what it is you're going to invest your energy in so that you have the motor to do it. Can you talk a little bit about what that looks like what the process is, and how you know, how you knew when you woke up that morning, today's the day to do LCAP? Because it wasn't planned at that point, right? You had stopped it and said, I'm not going to do it yet, I'm not ready, and then you got up before the camera crew and headed out on your own, I think. Is
no,
that accurate?
With LCAP, no, I mean, in some ways, like, with freestyling LCAP, it was the culmination of this several-year journey. I mean, it had been a multi-year dream to do it, and with that, there were ups and downs along. I mean, for many years, I just kept hoping that I'd come into Yosemite and look up at the wall, and it would look easy one year, and I'd be able to do it. And after, I guess, 6 or 7 years of coming to Yosemite and realizing that it just looked just as scary every year, I was like, this is never going to look easy. And so then I kind of realized that I was going to have to put all the prep work in and do all the effort without actually knowing whether or not I'd be able to achieve the goal at some point, which to me was a sort of important turning point, realizing that I would have to put all the work in without really knowing what the outcome might be, but that I would never know if it was possible without putting the work in first. And that was a big difference, because a lot of the other free solos I've done, I kind of knew I could do it, and then I just put the work in knowing that I would get to that point. With LCAP, I didn't really know if it was possible or not, but I've finally decided that it was important enough to me that I should put in the work and do the grind, and then find out if it was possible. And so, by sheer coincidence, the filmmakers who made the film Free Solo, Jimmy Chin and Chai Vassarelli, they approached me at that same time about doing a feature documentary of some kind, and I had basically just decided that I was going to start really putting effort into LCAP. And so it was fortuitous timing that they came to me right at a time when I was like, okay, I'm ready to work on a big project, and so they were sort of there. It's like having a training partner, having somebody to help hold you accountable to. I was like, this is this goal that I want to work on, and now these people showed up that want to film me working on a goal. I was like, what good timing. They can help me work on the thing I want to work on. And so then I started the two-year process of actually preparing specifically for LCAP. And it's true that when I started that two-year process of really working on the wall, I didn't really know the outcome. I didn't know if it was possible. But by the end of that 2 year, it's kind of like, okay, I've done all this work. I've been dreaming about this for almost a decade. I want to do this. You know, and I got to the point where I was as prepared as I could possibly be, and, you know, it was just time to do it.
I'd like to follow up. If you've seen the movie Free Solo, you see there's a moment where you fall and you injure your foot, and I think the very next scene is you climbing a rock wall with the boot on. We've all seen the sort of little pieces of the mountain that you're grabbing onto. I'll let you all know you have a very impressive handshake. You know, talk to us about, you know, there's a part of this, which, you know, Mr. Carver's saying, which is the preparation, the details, that sort of persistence, but there's also a physiology, a mental sort of strength, a physical strength. Your hands have to be in good position. Can you talk to us just about that part of how you make this all happen?
Well, I think that's kind of the, when you talk about preparing for LCAP, there are really two parts to it. There's the physical side and the mental side. The physical side is relatively straightforward in that you just train like any other athlete would train. You just do the workouts, you build the muscles, you do whatever you need to do in the same way that a runner can train to run a marathon just by sticking to the plan and working at it. So the physical side of the training isn't that, I don't want to say it's not hard because obviously you have to work really hard and eat really well and get enough sleep and, you know, all the things like work on your diet. Like, it's hard to be a good athlete, but it is known. It's understood how to do it as long as you can stick to the plan and carry on. The mental side is more unknown. Because when you're working on something that hasn't been done before, and you don't really know if you can do it or if anyone else, you know, the mental side is much more gray. So you're like, I think I can do it, I want to do it, but can I actually do it? And that's kind of why you spend so much time preparing, because you have to find out before you risk your life.
The last thing I want to unpack from the video, and it's interesting, and maybe I've overthought this, but you talk about how being pumped is risky for you. And I've heard you talk about it in a couple different situations where if your energy level spikes or if you all of a sudden get really excited, overexcited, it puts you at risk. That's really different than sort of the common approach to sort of like athletes in ball sports and all that, where you see the sort of adrenaline rush and then leveraging it to their advantage. Can you talk a little bit about what that means and how you get yourself into a space to moderate that?
So I don't know if this is true because I'm not good enough at any other sport to really know the difference, but I suspect that the most elite performers in other sports are similar in that, like, Tom Brady is for sure not getting a rush every time people run at him. He's cool as a cucumber. He just drops back, throws the ball really far, and he's chill. And I suspect that he can remember the entire game afterward. He can remember what he did. He, you know, it's like, I'm sure it's just a normal day at the office for him. And I suspect that's true for most sort of elite performers. Like, I mean, I doubt, like, Formula One drivers, for example, there's no way that they're just on, like, amp the whole time because, well, because physiologically your body just can't handle that level of, you know, sort of strain the whole time. So I think that really to do challenging things like that, you have to train and prepare to the point that it feels relatively normal. Mm-hmm. And especially with LCAP, I had to put in the hours, work on it until it just felt almost like a normal day of climbing. Obviously, it never quite feels normal because you're still doing something you've never done before. It's still exciting. It's still scary. But you can at least make it feel somewhat normal.
I'd love to follow up on that. There's a moment at the end of Free Solo when you get to the top of that impressively tall point, and I think you say, I'm so delighted. And there's this moment about halfway up where everyone who's watching the film, I don't know what the actual spot's called, but it's like a ninja kick or you have to jump.
Kick.
And, you know, and of course the music is very tense and there's all these things, like, what's going to happen? And you go, oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's really great. And it's like, I think everyone who's watching takes a deep breath. There's obvious joy in what you do. Can you talk about, we've talked a little preparation, we've talked a little bit about the physiology, sort of mental strength, but if you didn't love it, right? So talk to us a little bit about the joy in the work and the sort of the excitement that it brings you, the fulfillment that it brings.
Yeah, I mean, that's... Yeah, exactly. I mean, I love rock climbing. I love going climbing day in and day out. I mean, I still probably climb 5-ish days a week, maybe a little less right now just because we have 2 small babies at home, which makes it a little harder. But in general, I've been climbing 5 days a week for 28 years. Basically, it's like a lot of time spent climbing because I love going out climbing. And I think actually the thing, so in the film, you see those moments of joy when I'm on the wall doing the free solo. You're like, oh, this is so incredible. But what you're not seeing is that the 2 years of prep work that I put into it, most of that prep work, we're up on the wall for 8 hours a day. And the whole time you're up on the wall and you're using ropes, you're with partners, you're working on things, you're trying to memorize handholds and footholds, and you're just kind of working. But the thing is, you're still in one of the most beautiful places on earth, and you're still having a good time, and you're with your friends, and you look around, and you're like, this is so great. And so I think that that's what's part of what makes it possible to put in hours of preparation, is that it's just, you know, I enjoy every aspect of it. Like, I just like climbing. So every day that you're up there working at it, it doesn't really feel like working. It feels like you're out playing with your friends.
Thank you.
You've spoken in a couple of different interviews about the role that visualization plays for you. Can you talk a little bit about
visualization. But one of the interviews, it sort of sounded like you talked about how difficult it was to find the space to really make visualization valuable for you. So can you talk about what your process is for using visualization, where it fits into your preparation, and what you think the advantage of it is?
Yeah, so actually visualization, I think, is similar to what I was just saying about the preparation more broadly, is that it kind of breaks down into the physical and the mental side. And so with visualizing for LCAP, part of the visualization was just helping me to memorize left hand, right hand, the specifics of should I grab this hold and then cross my other hand up. And so I'm imagining the moves and I'm sort of like pantomiming or like memorizing a dance routine. It'd be similar to just thinking through the sequence of moves or like, okay, foot over this and then foot up here and then kick this foot over. You know, so part of it's that physical side where you're just memorizing movement. But then the maybe more important side of visualization is imagining what the emotional state will be like when you're doing something that you haven't done before. And I think that's actually applicable to any time you're experiencing some kind of new experience. When you're going to have to do something that you've never done and you can't just do it several times to practice. And so you just imagine all the things that could happen. Like, what will it feel like? What will it look like when I look down at my foot and there's no rope and, you know, and I see this 2,500 foot drop to the ground? You know, like, and I think that's the time to really play through all the what ifs. And I think, you know, I mean, there's sort of conflicting wisdom on this, but, you know, about positive visualization, negative visualization. But to me, it's important to visualize every aspect of an experience. And so that ranges from the moment of getting to the top and just feeling like, I'm the man, I did this thing, I'm so psyched. And then also ranging to falling off and bouncing off the wall and dying at the base, which is a horrible, when you really visualize it, it's a horrible thing because the wall's not really vertical, so you bounce a bunch and it's a horrendous way to die. And so sorry, this is cool, but I don't know. But honestly, I think that's really important because when you talk about managing risk, you need to be fully aware of what the risks are and what the outcomes are because you don't want to get up into a position and then suddenly realize, like, oh, if I fall here, I could die. You're like, you want to have done all that thinking ahead of time, and that's where the visualization comes in. It's like you want to have imagined every potential scenario ahead of time so that when you're actually doing the thing that you're trying to do, nothing new springs to mind and distracts you from the experience that you're having.
So your memory can play tricks on you, but I believe that when you did solo a cap, you actually started up one point and then you backed away and you reverse climbed down because you were like, this isn't the day. For me, this is one of the most important moments in the movie and maybe one of the most important moments for you to talk about because you prepared meticulously. You were ready. You had a crew of people that were there waiting on you, watching you. I'm assuming in many ways their livelihoods depended on it. Certainly their Academy Awards depended upon it. You took the moment and you said, this isn't the day. You walked away to come back for another day. Can you talk about, one, the why, but two, like, what the reserve in you is to maintain that? Like, it sounds like that's part of the visualization, that you get up there and maybe there's a disconnect between what you visualize and what's happening, and that trigger is, okay, this isn't the day, I'm going to walk away. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I thought it was an incredibly courageous, mature decision that couldn't have been easy to make in that time. It felt like there was some pressure.
Yeah, there's definitely some pressure. When all your friends are up on the wall and you've been training and there's a whole film crew and there's a budget and it's like a whole thing and you're sort of like, this is my moment, and then you start into it and you realize this isn't my moment. I actually don't feel great. I'm not really executing in the way that I'd like. There were some other factors involved in that. Partially, so that failed attempt, for those that have seen the film, that was in maybe early November. It was like late in the autumn. And so just in the autumn when the sun is lower in the sky, the wall gets sun earlier, so it means you have to start in the dark, but it's also late in the season, so it's quite cold. So you're starting in the dark and it's cold, so you can't really feel your fingers and toes quite as well. And I had recently injured my ankle, and so my foot was still kind of swollen, and so in my climbing shoe it was just too swollen, and I just couldn't feel my foot. And then I got to a section of the wall where you're literally trusting your life to a few footholds. There's nothing for your hands, there's nothing to hold on to, so no matter how well trained you are and how strong your muscles are, it doesn't really matter because there's nothing to hold. You just have to trust your feet and walk across this little slab. And I couldn't feel my toes, and I was just like, I shouldn't do this. And, you know, the reality is that had I just rolled the dice and tried anyway, you know, I probably would have done it. I wouldn't have been able to feel my toes, but I probably would have stuck it, you know, probably would be fine. But I wasn't really comfortable with probably. You know, even thinking about it now, I'm kind of like, probably isn't quite good enough for a situation like that. And so even though there was a tremendous amount of pressure, I just bailed there. I started cheating by grabbing the protection bolts as a way to make it a little bit easier. And so I cheated my way across and then went higher up the wall, actually, so that I could escape off these fixed rappel lines. It's just a way to get down. So I wound up giving up after about 1,000 feet of climbing instead of doing the whole 3,000 foot face. And at the time, it was very disappointing. I mean, I felt like I totally failed because I wanted to do this thing. There's this whole crew there, everyone's watching, and then I just wasn't able to do the thing that I set out to do. So, I mean, in a way, it's deeply embarrassing. Now, in retrospect, though, I realized that I wound up putting 6 more months of effort into the whole. I trained harder, I came back, I prepared more, and then when I wound up doing it the next springtime, basically the next good season in Yosemite, I felt great. And that's what you see in the film, is that the actual execution was really good, I was really happy, everything went smoothly. And so now in retrospect, I'm like, well, obviously spending 6 more months to work on your life dream is worth it. You know, but at the time, it felt very disappointing.
I know we're gonna open up for questions in just a few moments, so if you've got them, be thinking about them. I'd like to ask a question that I think will segue into that, which is, thinking about the number of times you've succeeded, and we really celebrate that in lots of different ways, whether it's through media, through it's your own personal accomplishments, there obviously are some low points, right? There are times when it doesn't go the way you want. And I'm just gonna ask our students here, how many times you've tried to do something you thought was gonna go well and it didn't go well? How many people here have experienced something that maybe didn't go quite right? So just look around, that's all of us. I'll put 2 hands up in the air. Maybe you could talk for just a minute, like, you know, practically, How do you pick yourself back up? What's you know? Do you have a technique? Is it friends that are around you? Do you have a coach? Is it just sort of going through the motions in your mind? Because it's as we just saw, it's a real thing. We all experience it, and we celebrate the success. But sometimes we don't always pay attention that even the most accomplished athletes, artists, academics have bad days, get down.
Yeah, it's interesting to talk about success and failure in rock climbing because. Rock climbing, you mostly spend all of your time failing because when you're training, when you're climbing outdoors with a rope, like so for example, this the image that we're seeing in the background, we spent 2 weeks working on this route. And so we were trying to do this, or 2.5 weeks. This was actually part of the Free Solo film, but it never made it in the film because it's a 90-minute documentary and they just had to edit a lot of things. But this was a several-week trip to China to climb this gigantic arch. And you know, it's maybe 800 feet of climbing out this arch feature. It's really, really cool. But you know, we're there for 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks, and trying to do one thing. And so we basically failed on it over and over as we worked on it. And then we had one day of quote-unquote success, and then we went home. And so that's kind of always the ratio in climbing, is that you'll spend months working on something, and you're basically failing as you grind, as you work away at it. And then if you do it once, and then you're like, okay, great success, I did a thing. And then you move on to the next harder thing, where you continue to fail for months and months. And so... So one of the things that I think of in rock climbing specifically is that you never really fail when you don't succeed in doing something. You just haven't done it yet. You know, there's always the next season. And like what I was just describing with my quote-unquote failure on El Cap is I just came back the next spring better prepared with a better plan, trained harder, and then did it. And so the only real failure is if you walk away from it and give up entirely. But as long as you keep trying, you've never really failed. You know, which is a little bit different in zero-sum sports. You know, like if you're playing basketball and your team loses, you did just fail, basically. Not really. I don't know if anyone here plays basketball. But, you know, it depends on how you look at it. You can still sort of adopt a growth mindset. Does anyone play basketball here?
Yes.
do they win ever?
They do.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Very good basketball program.
Yeah.
So... We have a few more questions for Alex, but it would be great if you've already identified and you have a question, if you could just line up behind one of these two mics, and then we'll call you as you come up, if that would be all right. One of the things I did want to ask Alex, and I forgot the acronym again, so I think you said it twice before we got here, but can you talk a little bit about the Red Rock Ascent you just recently did? And it's obviously a little local flavor for us.
Yeah, cool. So a year ago, I guess my daughter was, so last year, I did what I called the HURT, the Honnold's Ultimate Red Rock Traverse. It was a traverse of the entire Red Rock skyline, so every peak that you see, basically every colorful peak that you see, I chose the best climbing route and then tagged the summit and then down climbed the other side. So it wound up being something like 25,000 feet of vertical gain up and down every mountain that you see in Red Rock. Something like 11,000 feet of rock climbing specifically, and then a bunch of hiking as well to combine the peaks. The acronym, the name The Hurt is a play on this other very famous mountain traverse in Utah. But I also named it The Hurt because every time I worked on different segments of it, I came home kind of busted. I like always hit a cactus or scratched something or tripped or, you know, every time I came home, I was like, oh, I feel a little beat up. Yeah. Because it's, I mean, I assume all you guys have hiked in Red Rock at some point or gone outdoors here at least a little bit. I mean, you know that the desert can be unforgiving in many ways. It's everything is pokey, everything is sharp and kind of difficult. And so, so I pieced together this traverse the whole skyline. I kind of worked on it for several different seasons. It was like this back of my mind goal for a long time, because living here and looking at Red Rock all the time as a climber, you just can't resist this perfect long skyline. So
yeah, I was taken by the fact that while we were outside waiting to come in, you looked and said, if I'd known I was this close, I probably could have planned to go climb after this today. So.
Yeah, it turns out there's a kind of nice climbing wall that you can see from the front right there. The Lake Mead Buttress, this like limestone wall just above the school. I was like,
all right,
that's convenient.
Like Mr. P might have a question for you.
Of course I got a question. First of all, thank you, Alex. I've been looking forward to this day a lot. Extremely impressive career and awesome just mindset watching it all. So thank you. I listened to you speak a little bit about, while you were going towards this impossible task, you were evaluating if it was even possible while preparing for it, is what I'm hearing. And I'm curious, when you're evaluating something like that, can I even do this? Who is on your evaluation team? And is it, if it's just you, how do you trust that, you know, that's the only voice I need in the room? So just a little bit about how you came to the conclusion, yes, this is possible, and if you bounced that idea off of other people or you trusted yourself.
Yeah, that's a good question. So for most of the free soloing I've done in my life, I did it totally by myself. In the case of El Cap, it was sort of such a big project for me. It was so far beyond what I had done that it actually was helpful. And this is part of the reason that I agreed to do the film about it, is because I kind of knew that then there would be a built-in team for me to, so that I would have people to bounce ideas off of and to talk to about. I just knew that it was so big for me that I couldn't quite keep it all a secret by myself and do all the prep work without telling anybody. So I was like, I knew that it would take me months and that I would need people to help me with the ropes. And I was like, I just need a team to help me with this. In that case, you know, I had a few key friends and then people that were in the film. In the film, you see a couple of the professional climbers practicing with me. And so it was nice to have them to talk to about it and to practice different ideas and things.
I don't want to steal any time, but in that process, once I have my team, was there disagreement ever? And how did you have to kind of trust yourself instead of them? Or did sometimes people said, I don't know, man, this looks pretty.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because with free soloing, nobody will ever encourage you to free solo. Like your friends and family are never going to tell you, you should do that. Yeah. And so ultimately the drive always has to come from the inside. But the team was really helpful with more of the specifics of like, how do you do this specific challenge? And actually on El Cap, there were a few places where random friends of mine were like, why don't you use that holdover left? And I was like, what holdover left? And despite all the time that I'd spent on there, I'd never noticed that there was this big hold out to the left that I'd just never seen. And it made this one particular move on the wall suddenly quite a bit easier. I was like, oh, this is why you talk to people about it. Like, this is why you solicit other opinions and get slightly more diverse views, because you know, sometimes there are things that despite how much effort you've put in, you just don't see it yourself. And so it helps to have a team.
Thank you so much.
We'll go to the side.
Thank you for coming. And I just want to ask you, when you free solo, have you ever cramped? And what do you do like in that situation?
I've never really cramped. It's a school. Like, occasionally you have to go to the bathroom, which is maybe the closest thing to like an emergency where you're like, oh God, I really have to go to the bathroom. But no, never really cramping. And part of that, it's easy to mitigate that kind of thing just because you can practice with a rope ahead of time. So you have a pretty good sense of the physical exertion that it's going to require. In the same way that, you know, you can practice running a mile a bunch of times and you know roughly how that's going to feel. So when you go and do it, you're not expecting to cramp in the middle of the event. I mean, I think that's true for most athletes. You kind of know what you're about to do and you know your capabilities.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here today, Alex. It's great to share your experiences. My question is, I know that you've now got two young children. Congratulations on your last one. I understand you've got a new baby. And my question is, knowing everything that you know now, if your children decided that they wanted to free solo someday, how would you approach that? What would you say to them?
Yeah, I think that'll be an important question very soon, because my two-year-old daughter is now starting to climb, because we have a little home gym where I train a lot, and she's now walking over and climbing the walls as well. I'm sort of like, okay, well, two seems like early, but you're doing great. She's climbing. I think the thing to keep in mind is that free soloing is kind of a spectrum. I mean, we're seeing images of free soloing the biggest walls in the world and like super extreme, but there's also, but it's a spectrum that goes down to scrambling up rocks and scrambling on ridges. And particularly here in Red Rock, there's a ton of beautiful scrambling that you can do. And so I guarantee you that my daughter is going to scramble a ton. Whether or not she gains the skills and the confidence and whatever else it takes, kind of the desire to then solo, you know, free solo extreme rock faces, you know, we'll see. But I wouldn't discourage anybody from soloing, though, as long as they have the requisite skill, the requisite time, the preparation. You know, if you build up to it, it's fine. Because the whole point of free soloing is that you're trying to do things that are well within your abilities. And so if you build your abilities high enough, then it is relatively safe as long as you exercise good judgment and you're strategic about it. And so I think, you know, I would welcome my daughter learning enough about it to be able to do, you know, easy soloing comfortably. But we'll see.
How do your parents feel about you free soloing now? Have they gotten used to, like, the scare before every climb, or are they still the same as when you started?
Yeah, well, so the key thing is to not tell them ahead of time, which actually has always been my strategy. No, so my father actually unfortunately died when I was 19, so he sort of, which is really too bad because he spent so much time taking me to the climbing gym as a kid, but then he never really got to see me become a professional climber and for it to all happen. Because he always took me to all the youth competitions and things and, like, went climbing with me. But so he never really got to see it all. And then my mom, for many years, didn't know anything about climbing, full stop. And so she's just like, you're just doing that thing you love to do. Have a good time. I'd be like, and then by the time she had any idea what I was doing, I was already on the cover of magazines and in films and things like that. And so then she's like, well, he must be good at it. Just keep doing what you're doing. And so, you know. But I think the key to have people not worry is to, for them to not know ahead of time.
Thank you.
If you already broke the record, do you plan on keeping free soloing? Because, like, you've already done this crazy thing. So.
Yeah. That's a fair question. Yeah. So, I don't necessarily need to do any of the things that I've done again. So free soloing, I'll cap. I don't need to do the same route again. I don't need to try to beat my time or anything. But my goal in climbing is to improve as a climber, to, you know, sort of to perfect my own craft or to feel like I've learned something new, to do something that I couldn't do before. Like, I want to feel that feeling of improvement all the time. And so, you know, it means that I have to consistently seek out new challenges of some kind. And actually the Hurt, the Red Rock Traverse that we were just talking about, is an interesting example of that, because I climbed basically the 8 peaks across Red, you know, I did all this climbing in it took me 36 hours of continuous climbing and hiking, and I was very, very tired. And as I was doing all the prep work for it, I was kind of like, is this what it's come to? Is this what I have to do something new and that's exciting for me? Because in the past, doing any single one of the climbs would have felt great. And I was like, now I have to do 8 in a row to feel like I'm doing something new. I was like, this is kind of a grind. You know, I was like, this is a lot. And I mean, and that's kind of the challenge with consistently trying to one-up yourself or trying to improve on previous performances, is that at a certain point, you're like, do I have to do better? Like, do I need to do something even harder? Because it gets pretty hard. But, you know, but in general, I'd like to keep improving.
Thank you. When you're climbing, what do you usually think about?
That's a good question. So actually earlier I was saying that El Cap breaks down into sort of easy, medium, and hard sections, roughly. On the easy sections, actually it's analogous to running. When you're out jogging very slowly, you can think about anything. You can think about what you're gonna have for lunch and, you know, what you did yesterday. But if you're running as fast as you can possibly run, you really aren't thinking about anything. You're just breathing and your feet are hitting and that's it. And so with climbing, it's pretty similar. For the hardest climbing, I'm sort of on autopilot and I'm just letting my body execute the movement. But for the easy climbing, I'm looking around, I'm enjoying the birds, I'm thinking about my friends, I'm, you know, having a good time.
Thank you. Okay. I know you already mentioned this, but how do you use the bathroom when you're in an emergency?
Do we want to know?
Yeah.
Do we stop the camera?
I have so many harrowing stories of
pooping on the subject. We could do a whole
other episode. Honestly. But let's just say that it's extreme. Like, imagine hanging off the side of a cliff with one arm using the bathroom. It's extreme. But I have probably like a half dozen stories like that where things go sideways. Actually, partially from the Hurt, because I think I gave myself Giardia. I gave myself stomach issues from drinking the water in the canyons.
Oh, really?
Anyway, so it's all bad news.
Oh, wow. I think that answer will have to work.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
That's good.
Let's just say it's extreme.
Thank you for coming. Over the last couple of years, we've seen like a big rise in sports that are like lesser known. So my question to you is, where do you see the future of rock climbing?
Yeah, it's a good question about the future of rock climbing. I mean, rock climbing went into the Olympics in 2020 in Tokyo for the first time, and this year it'll be in the 2024 Olympics in Paris. I'll be there commentating. I mean, gyms have been seeing exponential growth. Basically, climbing in general has been growing like crazy. I don't know. I mean, I think it's great. I mean, I love climbing, and I think it's cool for other people to enjoy it as well. You know, mostly that just means that standards are rising as more people join the sport, and as the facilities are better, as gyms are better, people just get better at it sooner, and so you just see the standards of climbing rising very quickly, which is great.
Thank you.
How did you eat when you were rock climbing, and what did you eat?
Yeah, so depending on the scale of what I'm climbing, sometimes I'll have just a bar in my pocket or, you know, little water like clipped onto my chalk bag or something. With freestyling all cap, which is what we were mostly talking about, because there was a film crew involved and there's a lot of logistics around how they film, I just had them stash food and water for me in a few key places. So I knew that once I got 1,000 feet up, there's a big ledge, I can pop my shoes off, I can take a sip of water, I can eat a bar, and then I keep going. So there were just a few key stashes here and there. And then actually toward the top of the route, I passed one of the camera guys and I just took his water and drank his water. So I was like, we're doing it, I was all psyched. But,
Thank you.
Hi, do you ever consider yourself one of the most mentally tough people in the world?
I definitely do not consider, no. I mean, the thing is that you always feel totally normal on the inside. I'm just a dude that loves going rock climbing. I think that if there's any kind of mental toughness, is slowly built up over time. I think that one of the things I think that's interesting about rock climbing is that you wind up building a fair degree of toughness just because you're in the elements all the time. And so, you know, people are like, how do you stay humble or things like that? And you're kind of like, well, every time it rains, you get cold and wet and it's really scary. You know, and it, like, that kind of keeps you humble to some extent. And it kind of, and it reminds you that either way, you're just a frail human out doing something that you love to do. But if it gets too windy, you're going to get worked. If it gets too cold, you're going to get worked. It's like, you're always sort of at the mercy of the elements. And I think, you know, that's just a big part of the sport. And I think that's kind of what builds some of the I don't want to say mental toughness, but like quote unquote mental toughness. So you're like, well, you're just out and worked all the time.
Thank you. Good morning, Alex. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your statement to the community about the amount of rehearsal, choreography, and study in order to perform and do the solo. My ultimate question, though, is it took you several years to actually pull off this incredible achievement. How did you finance it? Who were your sponsors? And how were you able to maintain a sense of comfort so that you could continue to practice and be successful at this final endeavor? Thank you.
Yeah, well, so I've had sponsors for my whole climbing, you know, career. How much for my sponsors?
No, I mean, who are some of your sponsors? Give them a shout out right now. What are some of the things that they do that help you have the comfort to be successful?
Yeah, so my biggest sponsor is the North Face. Apparel is always the biggest category in the rock climbing world because rock climbing, despite the growth, is still a relatively small sport. So I'm also sponsored by, you know, shoe manufacturer like La Sportiva, like Technical Climbing Shoes, Black Diamond Equipment. They make climbing, you know, ropes and harnesses and things. So I'm sort of sponsored in each category, but the North Face being apparel is the largest just because they sell the most to non-climbers. But the most important thing, I mean, sponsors support you in various ways with gear and whatever, but the most important thing is they pay you, so you can just, you know, eat food. You know, it's like when you're starting out, people are like, oh, you know, we can give you exposure, and you're kind of like, well, I can't eat exposure. Like, I need to feed myself and feed my family now. But, you know, for all those years, though, I was living in my van, and so overhead is super low. I was basically traveling, following the weather, climbing full time. We still try to do sort of a month or so a year in the van with the family, but it's obviously harder with two kids now. But basically just living simply and working towards the ultimate goal.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks for coming. My question is, you probably like traveled worldwide for climbing. What's the coolest place you've been, or like the craziest place you've been?
That's a great question. Yeah, so I actually have put up new routes on all 7 continents, and I think I've been to 40 or 50 countries or something like that. I think one of the coolest places I've been is Antarctica. Just because it feels like going to space. It's the most completely different than anywhere else on Earth. I've done 2 expeditions to Antarctica to climb big mountains and then also to climb rock faces, so going rock climbing there. And it feels like being on Mars or something, though there's obviously a lot more water. But it's just so starkly different than anywhere else. It's incredible. And it's so remote, you're just out there.
Thank you.
Well, when you were climbing, did you listen to music?
Yeah, I do often listen to music. You don't see it in the film because they can't license all the music and they want the audio and everything. But I generally have my phone in my pocket and I just listen to it like a radio. I mean, I only do that if I'm by myself on a cliff because I don't want to, like, I never do that hiking because it's, like, annoying to everybody else. But I spend a lot of time just fully by myself in the middle of nowhere, so I often listen to music. But I never use earbuds or headphones because it's really important to be able to hear the rock as well. Because, like, if you grab something and you hear sand trickling out from behind it, it means it's, like, prying away from the wall. Basically, you have to be able to hear well, but I do like rocking out. And actually, an interesting thing about listening to music is that it's not just the sort of pleasure of listening to music, but also when I'm free soloing, I don't really have a great sense of pacing other than, you know, when I'm shuffling my favorite songs, I know they're each about 4 minutes, and so I have a pretty good sense of how quickly I'm climbing on a wall, and so I can use it to adapt my pacing.
Hi, we were wondering how long it takes to, like, go down and how you get down.
Okay, so yeah, getting down off El Cap, I like the tandem question.
Stereo.
I like stereo. So from the summit of El Cap, you can hike off the shoulder, and then there are a couple little rappels to get down, but basically you can hike down, and it's relatively easy. And from the top, I can run down in an hour. So it doesn't take too long. Normally you can hike up in about an hour or two, and you can run down in 50 minutes to an hour, if you've been doing it a lot, you know. I think for the average hiker, it takes, you know, half a day or whatever. But
thank you.
Hi. Did any family or friends ever, like, judge you for picking a career this dangerous?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, certainly at the beginning. Well, so it's a little different because it's not like I chose a career. You know, I mean, since we're in a school, I feel like this is a relevant backstory. So I went to UC Berkeley. And then that year was my last year of eligibility for youth international competitions. Anyway, I got invited to Youth Worlds for rock climbing. And so I was like, oh, I'll take a semester off school and I'll go do this international competition. And also that year my father died. And so there was a little bit less pressure to go to school. And I was a little like, I figured I'd take a semester off and go climbing internationally, do a little bit. And then I decided to take another semester off because I was climbing and I rather enjoyed it. And then, you know, now what it's been 30 semesters later and I haven't gone back. But in theory, I never officially decided I was dropping out of school. I just never went back. And so my career sort of built the same way, where it's not like I ever decided I'm going to be a professional rock climber, because when I was younger, that just wasn't even an option. Like the climbing industry was much smaller. There was no way that you could really be a professional. And so what I thought I was doing was just spending a few years doing this thing that I was passionate about, this thing that I love to do, and I thought that maybe I might become a mountain guide, maybe I'd go back to school, maybe I'd get into sort of, I don't know, like outdoor camps or something. You know, I was kind of open to anything, but then sponsors approached me and I started getting free gear and then they started paying me and pretty soon I was like, wow, I can support myself doing this thing that I love to do. That's incredible. And it sort of became a thing. But so at no point did I have to go to my family and tell them, I am dropping out of college to be a rock climber. You know, it was all a little more gradual. And I think that's kind of important because I think a lot of things in life unfold like that, where you're kind of like, well, you're not sure how it's going to play out, but you know that you love doing this one thing. You're like, maybe I should do this thing for a little while and kind of see how it unfolds.
Why'd you decide to start climbing with ropes to start climbing free solo?
Yeah, so it's a fair question. I mean, so I grew up climbing in the gym, climbing with ropes, bouldering, climbing short walls. But the thing is, free soloing is one aspect of climbing in the same way that mountaineering, climbing big mountains, is an aspect of climbing. Ice climbing is one discipline within climbing, and free soloing is one part of climbing. And so I always felt like I should at least try it. There's the whole cultural history around free soloing and climbing, and there are, you know, people I had looked up to as climbers who had done a lot of free soloing. And so I tried it a little bit just because I felt like it was important to know every aspect of climbing. And as it turns out, I like it. I'm well suited to it. It comes more easily to me than other aspects of climbing, maybe. And so, yeah, I just like it.
When you're training, where do you, like, put the rope so you don't fall? Because it doesn't just start at the top.
This means you have to go to the climbing gym and try sometime. So that's the type of question that you don't ask if you've ever gone climbing at the gym. You tie it into your harness. So you're wearing a harness, you tie your rope to the harness, and then as you climb up, you clip your rope into pieces of protection, so then if you fall off, the last piece of protection will catch you. Or occasionally the rope is already rigged over the top of something. Or like in the case of El Cap, I could hike to the summit of the wall and then tie the rope to the top and then work my way down using ropes. That way I could do a lot of the prep work by myself.
Do people like come up to you when you're like rock climbing and like recognize you and say hi and stuff? Like
Yeah, quite a lot, yeah. Yeah. No, in general, yeah. Yeah, I mean in a climbing area, yes, very much. But that's, you know.
Who is the most helpful person on the climb?
On the climb of El Cap?
Yeah.
I don't know, that's a good question. I mean, I don't know if one individual person stands out, but I think the film crew was an important part of the team for me. That was maybe five or six different friends who I spent 2 years with going up and down on the wall and getting into position. And so I wouldn't choose any one of them individually. Though if I had to choose an individual, I guess I would say Jimmy Chin, who's the film director, just because he was kind of the boss. And so he was wrangling the troops. He was getting everybody in position. I will say one thing that Jimmy did really well is that he's trying to make a film, but he was also trying to protect my experience as a rock climber. And so he didn't want the filming to get too much in the way of my climbing experience. And so they did a really good job with the documentary of balancing my needs as a climber, but also still making a good film.
Our time with Alex is winding down, so we're going to stop after the questions of folks that are standing. And just as a reminder for those of you who wanted to get a photo or have your book signed, Alex will be at the table afterwards. So I think we're over here. Is that right?
Thank you for coming and answering questions. I'm glad I got here in time. How did you do the bare minimum in school while dedicating so much time to sports and doing so well that you got into Berkeley? Well, I'm assuming that you wrote about climbing for your college essay?
Say that again? I did write a thing about... Yeah, but I did a thing on physics, I think, with... is that what you're asking?
How did you do the bare minimum while doing so well with both academics and...
Well, I'd say in some ways, doing the bare minimum is actually harder than doing your best, in a way, because feathering that line of, like, right on the edge is, like, it makes it all a little more extreme. Because if you just do your best, it's fine, because, you know, then you're doing really well. But to keep it right at the bottom of the bracket is a little bit harder, I think.
A lot of anxiety.
But, yeah, a lot more stress. I mean, which honestly is probably part of it. It's probably just trying to get a little more excitement out of the school experience in some way. But some of that is also just because I started, as I was a later teenager, I had more independence to bike to the gym by myself, and I was spending a lot more time at the climbing gym. And part of it... You know, I mean, part of being a rock climber, rock climbing has a strong countercultural sort of anti-authority vibe to it. And, you know, me getting a 90.0 at school was like a major, you know, sticking it to the man. Like, that's me being countercultural. And I was like, yeah, anyone can get a 95 or a 99, but getting a 90.0, that's saying, you know, that's thumbing... I don't want to say, you know, that's
but 99 is good.
Yeah. 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 Basically, it's like my version of acting up.
Do you remember, do you remember how many hours of sleep you got on average?
Don't know, but probably enough. Kind of. I slept through my first period quite often. But,
thank you.
But I wasn't an ideal student. You know, I didn't graduate college. You guys are all going to go to college, so.
Hi. I was just curious. I get how you don't have any, like, things attached to you when you climb, but if you were to fall, what would there be like any safety and like anything
while free soloing?
Yeah.
No. I mean, the whole point of free soloing is that you're just climbing, and so if you fall off, you're basically going to bounce off and die. You know, occasionally you might hit a ledge, maybe you'd stop some distance below, but you're basically just going to die.
Have you ever like fell from a, well, like,
no,
okay.
No, I would be
too
dead.
Far, yeah.
Okay. No, I've never fallen through soloing.
Wouldn't that be a story?
Yeah. No, there are plenty of stories of free soloists who have fallen. Like, so one of my good friends is a climber. He once fell from 90 feet up while soloing, and he fell 40 or 50 feet, landed on a ledge, basically broke every bone in his body, rolled off the ledge, went another 40 or 50 feet to the ground, broke the rest of the bones in his body. And he wound up in a stroke center for months. They like put him back together, but now he's like basically good. He's still climbing at a high level. And it's interesting because that
that is pretty good. That is pretty good.
Yeah. But all that to say, you should avoid falling if you're free soloing.
Thank you very much for coming and speaking with us. My question is, after the release and success of your movie, I'm assuming you got a lot more attention, both your career and also the field of rock climbing. Has there been any significant change to your career or the field? Because obviously you're going to interviews, you're coming to schools like this to speak. Is your life any more stressful than it used to be? Has it changed in any way?
Yeah, I'd say that life is definitely a lot busier. I mean, as a result of Free Solo, I do a lot more corporate speaking, public events, just like random things, and even just cool opportunities that present themselves. Like later this week, I'm doing something with David Letterman, like the late night host, and you're sort of like, cool, that's neat. Actually, I'm randomly doing a climbing thing in the morning with my Congress lady, Susie Lee, for anyone who's represented by Susie Lee, here in Vegas, and then flying to New York and doing a thing with David Letterman that evening. And I was like, oh, it's a bi-coastal climbing experience day with my Congress lady and David, you know, Mr. Letterman. I was like, huh, what a weird day. And so, yeah, definitely way more weird things like that come up that definitely take me away from climbing as much in some ways. But it's kind of all things that are cool opportunities. It's all choices that I'm making. So I feel pretty comfortable with it. I just have to be more strategic with my time. Like, I can still climb as much. I just have to be tight about the way I do it. I used to just go to the cliff and just spend the whole day at the cliff and, like, watch the birds and have a nice day. Now I go to the cliff with a little bit more intention and climb faster, get my climbs in, go home, go back to the family, go back to work, things like that.
Thank you.
Do you ever doubt yourself? And if you do, how do you handle it?
Yeah, I mean, like I was saying earlier, as a climber, you fail most of the time. And so doubt, I mean, self-doubt is common. I don't know how you handle it. I mean, I think, you know, with free soloing specifically, you can basically just always practice to the point that, you know, in a way, self-doubt is a story that you're telling yourself. But if you can go and physically do a thing, then basically you just kind of gather data as to, can I do this thing or not? And whether you're telling yourself a story about it doesn't totally matter, because if you've done something a bunch of times, you know that you can do it. And so whether you have doubts or not, rationally, you know that you can do a certain thing. And that's kind of the whole strategy with free soloing, is that, you know, it's like, I mean, this is the mental side of free soloing. It's like, you train with the rope, you try it a bunch of times, you practice, and you're like, I can do this. I have done this many times. I've done this many times without falling off. The numbers are on my side. It's like, I know that it's possible. And yet, it's still really scary to imagine doing it when your life is on the line. I mean, that's the whole game of free soloing, really, is like overcoming that doubt.
Hello, as El Cap being an amazing accomplishment in the free soloing community, do you have any plans on doing something more than free soloing El Cap? And if so, what would that be?
No plans. So it's hard to overstate how important El Cap is in the rock climbing sort of mythology. It's such a central wall in climbing history. It's so iconic. It is basically the most important wall in the world. And so to have spent almost a decade of my life dreaming about it, I mean, before I could even, like, when I was climbing in the gym, my big goal was just to climb El Cap. And then my big goal was to climb El Cap in a day, and then to free climb El Cap. And free climbing is different than free soloing El Cap. And so basically every step along the way of my climbing journey, El Cap has been central to my goals. Like, doing something on El Cap has always been the most important thing. And so it's kind of hard to imagine something beyond free soloing it, just because that's... That said, there are plenty of other ways that I would like to challenge myself as a climber and improve, but nothing will ever be quite as important as the most important wall in the world.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Alex, for being here. My question goes back to your childhood a little bit, because you sit here now, you're like being viewed as a superhuman by many of us, right? Especially people that are in sports. And as adults, we can say, oh, you know, we've become successful. People look up at you, but when you were in school, you said, you know what? I was kind of a goofy kid, and I had some insecurities and so on. You were quite an outlier, right? Undeniably, all these kids here are outliers too. They're here for a reason, right? This is a very special school in town. What advice do you have now, looking back, as to when you were in school and say, you know what? Yeah, you can make it. And all these social pressures and things that are going on nowadays that might affect our children and our students here. How can you help them with some advice from where you are now, looking back, to make it safely through school and do well and achieve what they want to achieve?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question, because I don't really know how you help somebody through that, because, I mean, as you said, I was the biggest loser in school. Like, I never, I mean,
did
it's...
Not, I did not say that.
Well,
I did not
say that. Yeah, but...
Point of clarification.
Yeah, but it is true. And, you know, it's like I was wearing, like, hand-me-down sweats my entire school years, because I just, like, didn't really care. In some ways, I would have done better at a school with a uniform, because at least that way, you know, that way you look like everybody else all the time. But I was just such a... I was so lame in school. But, you know, I don't know. Actually, something sort of tangentially related to what you're describing. We watched that video earlier, which I'd never seen before, and I don't know where it came from. But my one takeaway for school is, like, this is why you never search yourself online. This is why you don't check your likes, all this. There's so much weird content about me that exists on the internet that I haven't seen, I don't need to see, I don't care. You know, I think that's probably, you know, I was kind of lucky enough to grow up pre-smartphone, pre-social media, pre a lot of the things that are easy to suck you in and take your attention and sort of trap you in negative cycles. And now as an adult, you know, obviously I have social media because part of being a professional athlete is like having a big online presence and all that, but I don't have any of the apps on my phone. I let somebody else manage it and I just send them photos every once in a while and things like that. I think that basically staying removed from a lot of the social pressure is important. Like if you want to do something hard, just focus on the thing that you're doing, work on that, and ignore all the rest. You know, and now there's so much stuff around me publicly. Kind of like all I care about is the opinion of my family, the opinion of my friends. You know, like if I do something big, like, you know, a TV show came out earlier this year with this expedition I did to Greenland, is on Disney Plus, on National Geographic. Tons of people see it. There's tons of commentary online. There's all this press. There's all this PR. But the only things that I really care about are the texts I get from friends that are like, I watched your show. And I was actually surprised how many of my friends, because typically my real friends don't interact with any of my public facing, you know, they don't watch my TV show because they're like, who cares? We're like, we already know them. It's like, you know, we've already heard about it. Like, we don't care. But every once in a while, they do sort of watch something like that. I'm like, that means a lot to me. You know, it's like focusing on your own community and on your own goals. But that's so much easier said than done, because it's so hard to ignore all the other noise, like the rest of the noise out there.
Great answer. Ladies?
What has been your worst injury when falling?
My worst injury? Actually, the most common injuries in rock climbing are actually overuse injuries, which are really unglamorous and sort of undramatic. But because rock climbing relies on your fingers so much, it's common that you strain tiny, tiny little things like pulleys and ligaments, tendons, like things inside your fingers. And it feels totally stupid because you're basically completely fine, but you just can't quite pull as hard as you want with one finger, and that kind of takes you out of certain types of climbing for a while. So those are the most common injuries I've had to face. But I've, you know, tweaked my ankle, you've seen the film. But I've been lucky enough to never have any major injuries. Except when I was young, I broke my arm 3 times falling off things as a kid, which I think is why my parents took me to a climbing gym, because they were like, padded floors, it'll be great. But then, jokes on them, I broke my arm in the climbing gym, too.
Why did you move to Vegas?
Oh, Vegas is the best climbing in the country. Vegas is the best four-season climbing in the country. I love Vegas.
Let me start by thanking all of our teachers and staff for your flexibility this morning, all of our students for being such wonderful hosts today, and would you please help me thank and appreciate Mr. Honnold for being here as our guest today.
I'll be honest, I feel like it's going to be difficult to top that episode. We've got one more left this season, so we'll do our very best. Once again, I'd like to thank Alex Honnold. I would like to mention that he has a current series on Disney Plus called Arctic Ascent, that he also still has free solo available on most streaming sites. He also has a book called Alone on the Wall. There are a number of places where you can find more information about this one-of-a-kind visionary thinker and climber. Encourage you to do that. We're grateful that you joined us for this episode, and we'll see you next time at The Meadow.